Whether it's with human health or pet health, having good information is key to preventing or at least addressing issues before they get too serious. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Thanks for joining us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine takes time each month to spend with us to give us advice on keeping our pets happy and healthy. And Sandy, as always, great to see you.
It's nice to be here.
Well, we have lots to talk about, but we also want to let people know how they can join the conversation. You can call 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can go to our Facebook page and post a question, a comment, or a pet photo. We always like to see those. On the Facebook page, that's The Larry Mueller Show, and Mueller is spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Well, Sandy, one of the things we definitely wanted to talk about was blue-green algae. Dogs spend much more time outside in the summer and often around water. What should we be keeping in mind?
And that's the problem, is dogs will drink from sources that we would never even consider stepping into, let alone they are swimming in it and drinking. And so it's up to us to be able to look at and try to assess water quality and, you know, really paying attention to areas that where they say, hey, you know, the beach is closed or whatever. I tell people just, you know, get a little pool for your dog in the backyard, you know, be really careful this time of the year, because it doesn't take much. And I think just ingesting the water besides blue-green algae toxicity, which can be fatal. And I think so many veterinarians may be seeing it, but not really knowing what they're seeing, because these dogs come in with all kinds of symptoms that look like other things like diarrhea and vomiting, or maybe they're jaundiced, meaning that their liver is affected, or they start seizuring. Sometimes they just die, and it's, you know, very difficult to treat. It's supportive care, and that's it. So we're, you know, I think we have to be smart for our dogs. Besides blue-green algae, though, a lot of standing water will also carry other bacteria that can be a problem. There's one called leptospirosis, which is not only a problem for pets, but also for humans as well. And we probably at the vet school see diagnosed 2, 3, 4 cases a month, depending on the time of the year. And, you know, pets usually come in with either kidney failure or liver disease. And so, again, that's one of those things where have them vaccinated, but avoid those areas where they're standing water if at all possible.
And so just to reiterate, it's not just if they're drinking it, skin contact can be
an issue. It can, and just mucous membranes, eyes and so on, especially for lepto. Yep.
And, you know, if we do think that our pup might have come into contact with it, either drinking or getting it on them, maybe, you know, it's hard to tell if the water they were in had the algae or not. What should we specifically be looking out for?
Well, anything that's, you know, just even slight changes in the dog's temperament, you know, normal behavior, contacting your veterinarian right away if you're suspicious of it. I mean, if we're really suspicious, sometimes we can make them vomit, and there's ways that we can do that, and that would be something the veterinarian could help with. There are some at-home methods using hydrogen peroxide and so on. But, you know, even just, you know, bathing your dog afterwards, I think may be very helpful. Not so much for toxicity issues, but, you know, all that, even if it's not blue-green algae, we'll see dogs get some pretty nasty skinish, you know, irritation just from the stuff that's in the water. So bathing them when they get out as well.
Well, and here's an interesting companion to that. Sandy posted on Facebook, my cat fell into a rain barrel 2 weeks ago that had standing water in it. 3 days later, she developed a urinary tract infection, and she had never had one before. Could she have gotten that UTI from the dirty water in the rain barrel? She also caught her drinking that water on a couple of occasions.
Yeah, and that is a good question, but I'm going to just change the topic just very slightly. Urinary tract infections in cats that are under 10 years of age are absolutely rare. I mean, we hardly ever see actual urinary tract infections where you can take the urine, culture bacteria, and find bacteria in it. What we see very commonly in cats, especially after a stressful event, like falling into a rain barrel and getting stuck in there, is 2 or 3 days later, they start passing bloody urine. The cat's bladder is kind of their stress organ. We get gastric ulcers and we get an upset stomach when we get upset. Cats, it's their bladder. And so sometimes just a stressful event like that can trigger the cat to have bloody urine, and we call it sterile cystitis, because you can culture these cats and their urine's negative, but they have blood. And fortunately for most of these cats, within a few days it goes away. if you are seeing blood in your cat's urine, obviously it's important to have it checked out to make sure, because we still see maybe 2 to 3% of the cats with blood in their urine will have a urinary tract infection. But, you know, so get it checked out. But, you know, just throwing a cat on an antibiotic because there's blood is not good medicine. And guess what? They get better in 5 to 7 days, whether they're on an antibiotic or not. So, yeah. So just that's maybe what happened with that cat, is just very, very stressed.
It seems like it also might be a good idea to figure out a way to cover that rain barrel.
Oh, definitely.
Because not just her cat, but other animals could get in there, and I would think there could be a drowning.
Oh, yeah.
Risk.
Squirrels and so on. Yeah, definitely. Depending on the you know, how deep the water is. So, yeah, get a cover for it.
And actually, talking about other summertime issues, the Lone Star tick is now in Wisconsin. We've talked about that with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. And you were saying, Sandy, that this is especially an issue for cats.
Definitely. You know, we practice good tick control in this state because we know we've got Lyme disease, we've got lots of tick problems, and people with dogs are usually pretty good about using something, and we're almost to that point where we need it year-round. I heard somebody say the other day, you don't need tick control 365 days a year, but you need it for 12 months a year. And what we mean by that is that when I started looking at temperatures, we had ticks out even in January this year. There were times when the temperature goes above 35, deer ticks can come out, even when there's snow on the ground. So practicing tick control year-round is really important. The reason why I'm concerned about cats is that, you know, cats typically groom the ticks off before they get a chance to start feeding. And we just don't see that many tick-borne diseases in cats. But this new tick that has come to our state, the Lone Star tick, is carrying some of them carry a disease called cytozoonosis, and it's a deadly disease for cats. So what do? We have to practice good tick control on our indoor-outdoor cats as well. And there's not very many products that we can use on cats that are safe, except for maybe things like Fipronil Frontline. There's a collar out that lasts for 8 months called the Seresto collar that is used for dogs and cats. But you have to be careful. There's a lot of tick control agents for dogs that you can't use in cats. Very, very toxic. Mm. So don't just grab something off the shelf because it says it gets ticks. Make sure it is approved for cats. And so if you have an indoor-outdoor cat, better get them on this, because there really isn't any treatment except supportive care for this disease.
Another summer topic is that August 15th has been deemed Check the Chip Day.
Yeah.
What is that?
Well, what this is it's just something that, I don't know why we veterinarians are starting it, but it's what we want to do is encourage people to, if their pet is microchipped, to make sure that it's registered and that the information is updated. So many people will have a pet and then move and not change that information in the database. And I kind of equate having a chip that isn't registered or without updated material like having a cell phone without a phone number. You know, it's pretty useless. So make sure that your chip is kept up to date. And there is a way, if you don't know if your chip is current or not, there's a website. This is called Microchip Lookup, and it's run by the American Animal Hospital Association. Anybody can go on it. You enter your pet's microchip number, and it will tell you which company it's registered with and if it is registered. And it may say, well, this looks like a chip from this company, but we have no information in the database. Then they have an 800 number there, a website offered that you can go and get that taken care of. Every pet that comes into my clinic, I scan to make sure the microchip is working. And I think that should just be part of your routine. Every time you go in to the vet, is the microchip still readable? I've had a couple of failures. It doesn't happen very often, and then the companies are usually pretty good about replacing this.
So even if you're keeping it registered, there's a chance.
There's
the chip
a chance
itself.
It may not be readable. Yep.
Good advice. Well, we are talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine today. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in for Larry Mueller. And let's go to Dawn in Duluth, who has another summer-related question. Hi, Dawn.
Good morning, ladies. My golden retriever and I will be going on a week-long canoeing trip in the BWCA in August. I often set up a tarp in her section of my canoe where she can go to get shade if she chooses. I'm wondering if I should use any type of sunscreen or eye protection for her for the times that I cannot set up a tarp.
That's a good question. It really depends on the dog. If they are, well pigmented, it's not a huge problem for them, but we see a lot of dogs that have, you know, lightly pigmented noses. And, you know, there's some dogs, like, I mean, obviously your dog, you know, isn't one of these breeds, but we had a, one of the hairless dogs in that had been at a boarding kennel and left out and got sunburned, and a pretty nasty skin problem with that. So, you know, you have to know your dog. And if you find that your dog's nose gets a little red or irritated, yes, using some type of a waterproof sunblock on your dog's, you know, especially the nasal plenum, that top of the nose is probably the most critical. Sometimes ear tips and things can get irritated as well. Yeah, so, and kind of use your judgment. And the stuff that they make for kids is usually pretty safe. They do make dog sunscreen as well. You're going to pay a lot more for it. And, you know, I think if you're putting it on an area where the dog can't lick, it's not a huge problem. When it comes to eye protection, yeah, you know, do dogs need to wear sunglasses? Can they get cataracts? Definitely they can get cataracts. But, you know, I don't know if they've shown a link between, you know, UV exposure and cataracts in dogs. We know that a lot of dogs that have cataracts will end up, it's because it's genetic for the breed. But they do make these things called doggles, which are like, eye protection for dogs. And when we have some dogs that have, you know, chronic eye diseases and they're running through the woods all the time, people will use them on their dogs, and it gives them good eye protection so that they don't get poked or have any irritation. The trick is getting the dog to wear them. It does take some training. A lot of dogs don't like them.
Dawn, how many times have you taken your dog on these kind of trips?
Oh, many times.
Yeah.
She's a seasoned pro.
Yeah.
She's great in the canoe.
Good, good. I haven't been up there for a long time, but it is one of my favorite places to go. So have fun.
Thank you.
Thanks, Don. And let's go next to Diana in Blair. Hi, Diana.
Good morning. During my Corgi Mix's physical exam this year, he was found to have a heart murmur. And I was wondering, other than keeping his weight down and that type of thing, what could be done for him at least to keep him comfortable?
How old is he?
He'll be 14 sometime in November. I'm not quite sure.
Okay.
But,
so yeah. He's an elderly guy.
He's an older boy. Yeah. When they did a study looking at longevity of and causes of death for dogs, what they found is that for smaller breed dogs, hormonal problems, endocrine diseases, and heart disease are probably two of the big top end-of-life causers for pets. Just because your dog has a murmur, though, I don't think you really have to be that concerned, unless it's like, you know, the vet has said it's like a high-grade murmur, or they're finding other things to indicate that the dog may be in trouble. Weak pulses, not being able to exercise well, coughing a lot. Those would be all symptoms that say, we better look into this a little bit more. I just had a dog in yesterday that was a 14-year-old Papillon that had a pretty significant murmur, and the owners were saying, yes, the dog is coughing all the time. And so we had to try to figure out, is this dog in heart failure, where blood and fluids are building up and backing up into the lung fields, and the dog is basically drowning when they're in heart failure? Or is it something else? And so we took an x-ray, and I think that that's always helpful, not only for, you know, monitoring the dog, but to give you some peace of mind as well. What we found on that particular dog on x-ray, that yes, the heart was big, and it was big enough that it was pushing on the airways, and that's what was causing the coughing. It wasn't that the dog was in heart failure. And so it made the owner feel a lot better that, you know, their dog wasn't suffering so much. And we've got the dog on some meds to help make the heart pump a little bit better. So I think in your case, hearing that murmur, maybe go back to your veterinarian and say, can you tell me what the grade was? And we grade them on a scale of 1 to 6, 6 being the loudest. And what were the pulses like? You know, and maybe say, if it is a mid-grade to high murmur, can we get a chest x-ray done? Just to be able to have a look. If you want to go the next step up, that would be then probably visiting with a cardiologist and getting an echocardiogram done to be able to see how well the heart is actually pumping and what's causing the murmur. 14-year-old dog, it's probably some age-related valve disease. Those poor heart valves just sometimes just start to give out. And yeah, so keep a close eye on your dog, and hopefully that heart is not going to be the problem.
Thanks for that call, Diana. We are talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, and there's lots more to talk about keeping our pets happy and healthy with Dr. Sandy right after this short break. Stay tuned. Right now, we're talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk about keeping our pets happy and healthy. And Sandy, let's go right back to the phones and Betty in Mercer. Hi, Betty.
Hi there. How are you, Sandy?
Oh, I am just fine.
Oh, God, love you. I'm on the road, but I happen to hear that you were on, so your voice lady said, stay where you're at and don't move. So I have a question about my daughter's dog.
Okay.
We were on a trip, and the dog is part black lab and Dalmatian, and she had the most pungent smell of anything that was very hard on the nose.
Okay.
Now, what would cause that? And she's a rescue dog, so I don't know too much about what it was before. But is there anything that can be done, whether it's either in a diet or a spray or anything, to eliminate this awful smell?
Now, was this something that just came on suddenly, or is it just the dog always has this like nasty body odor?
I do not know, because she's in Arizona, and of course we were on a trip to Yellowstone.
Okay. Well, there's a few things that I would be thinking about for having a bad body odor. If it just came on suddenly, where the dog's fine, and then all of a sudden you just got this whiff of this foul kind of metallic smelling material. No show that is this close to lunchtime, we can never get by without talking about anal glands, okay? And they are, every dog has them, cats have them as well, and all it takes is a drop or two of this material that comes from these glands that are normally emptied when they have a BM, to just make your car smell. And I mean, I've had it on me and I'm like, oh, where is it? You know, like, and it just takes like one drop on my lab coat and it ruins my day. But, so that may be what it was. And in that case, you know, especially if the dog's showing any symptoms, like rubbing their bottom on the ground, turning around and licking at their rectum, it may indicate that those anal glands are overly filled or impacted and may need to be expressed. So that would be one thing I'd be thinking about. Other things were, if it's a constant odor, the dog just smells all the time, I'd be looking, doing the head-to-toe look, looking in the mouth to see if the dog has dental disease. You'd be surprised how many dogs are walking around with pretty horrific periodontal disease, and then when they're licking themselves, they're depositing this foul-smelling saliva all over their body. Sometimes dogs have ear infections. Especially with yeast and things that can be pretty stinky. We'll see dogs that lick their feet and have foot, you know, infections between their foot pads, and that can be a source of body odor as well. And even, like I mentioned earlier in the show, swimming in some of the lakes and things, and then having that algae residue stuck in the hair coat, they start to smell like a silo, like fermented organic material, and it can be pretty nasty on the nose as well. So those would be all things that I would be looking at, ruling out infections, making sure anal glands are empty, and kind of take it from there. One of my favorite odor eliminators that we use when we're expressing anal glands, or we've got, you know, a bad odor that we have to try to get rid of, is called Animal Odor Eliminator, AOE. And you can buy it over the counter. It's a spray that can be used on the dog, on a human, on, you know, the surface, and it actually biologically changes the smell producing molecules, and it actually makes the you know, something bad smell quite pleasant. So that might be something to travel with if this is going to be a problem for the dog.
Thanks for that call, Betty. And you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also post a question, comment, or a pet photo on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. And Sandy, we had a couple callers ask that you clarify what you said about indoor cats needing tick protection. We were talking about the Lone Star tick.
Yeah, indoor cats probably not. You know, unless you've got dogs that are bringing ticks back into the house again. So if they're strictly indoors, they really aren't at risk. risk. But if you've got an indoor-outdoor cat, definitely have them on flea and tick control. And probably year-round would be the best bet.
Chris, a listener, Chris, called to say that she lost her cat yesterday. Her cat passed away, and she had just been diagnosed with sugar diabetes. She's feeling guilty for not detecting it herself. She wonders why animals don't show pain when they suffer like this, and also whether you can address helping another pet deal with the loss of their companion.
Oh, all things that are, you know, things that really need to be addressed. Why do animals not show pain? It's a natural preservation response. We like to get flowers. We like to have sympathy. So when we have something bugging us, we tell the world, oh, I have a toothache. Oh, I have a headache. But pets, if they start complaining and showing that they are weak for whatever reason, just like, you know, a gazelle on the savannah in Africa is going to, if they start limping, they're going to get picked out from the herd as prey. And so our pets do exactly the same thing. They hide symptoms. They just aren't going to show the same kind of things that we do. And so it's up to us as owners to, one, make sure that your pet is going in for routine physical exams. And as they get older, getting some lab work done, because they may not be showing symptoms, but may have something like diabetes or kidney disease that can be diagnosed and treated earlier. And paying attention to just very subtle things, like your cat with diabetes may have been drinking more water. The water dish may have been needing to be filled up more often. They may have been eating more. They may have been losing weight. And so if you start noticing some changes in their normal behaviors, that's the kind of stuff that needs to be investigated as well. And, you know, when it comes to, getting a pet that's at home used to being the only pet in the household, the only advice I can give you is, even though you are grieving right now over the loss, really try to stick with the same schedule that you've always had, the same feeding schedule, play schedule, again, just so that the whole house isn't in turmoil, because that can just add to the grief with the other pet as well. And make sure, even though you may be thinking, oh, I want to go out and get another cat, especially another cat, not all cats want another cat in the household. And even though these two cats may have been good buddies, introducing another one, if you are going to do that, make sure it's because you want another cat, not because you think your cat wants another cat. And go about it very, very slowly. Let them get to know each other at a distance, behind closed doors, and very gradual introduction to avoid fighting and conflict that way, which is just going to make things worse for everybody.
I also know that Dr. Carrie Donahue, who is on and talks about holistic pet mm-hmm. issues, has addressed this and has said that there are some homeopathic remedies that can help. Like, I think it's Bach flowers, the rescue remedy.
Yeah, and those are very, very safe things to use. They're
soothing.
And there's a thing called for cats. The facial pheromone called Feel Away. Some cats do better with that. It makes them feel more relaxed and comfortable. Typically, we don't jump to prescription anti-anxiety meds or anything along that line. But I think any of the safe over-the-counter products like that, you can use them. And if they help, great. If they don't, you know, you're not going to be harming your cat.
And I think all of us have been there. So we send our sympathy to you, Chris.
Yeah,
it's always difficult. Diane in Mercer is next. Hi, Diane.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a 5-month-old puppy, German Shepherd. They said Bull Terrier. I got him from the Humane Society in Hayward. And I've been taking him running with me in the mornings with my other dog, and I'm wondering if that is okay for him.
It really depends on often large breed dogs. If you really push them and you're pounding the pavement with them on those developing joints, that can aggravate different diseases that they can get, like hip dysplasia and so on, and can cause them more problems as they get older. So I usually tell people, wait until they're full grown before you start going out and running. And when does that happen? It really depends on the size of the dog. Probably 9, 10, 12 months of age, you know, in that range would be a good time to think about, okay, now we can go out and start hitting the pavement. Can you go to a dog park and run? Can you run on grass and do things? Oh, by all means. Softer surfaces, no problem. But you just want to be really careful with that, you know, running on concrete and pavement.
We're on gravel roads most of the time.
Yeah, and that may be a little harsh for a young developing dog, too. So maybe go out for a short run with them, take them home, and then finish your run with your older dog and so they can get the exercise they need.
Thanks for that call, Diane. And let's go next to Karen in Oshkosh. Hi, Karen.
Hi. We have an almost 12-year-old dog who our vet thinks has an insulinoma, the tumor on the pancreas, mm-hmm. that secretes insulin, I guess. And we had he has all the symptoms that go with that, the kind of collapsing and
low blood sugar. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, low blood sugar and then high insulin.
Okay.
Anyway, we had an ultrasound done, and they couldn't see the tumor, but and we couldn't go any further that day, and because it was that day of the awful storm in Appleton, and that, nothing else was working. Anyway, for the several days after that, he was in absolute misery. He wouldn't eat. He wouldn't drink. He was just miserable. And then on Friday, I fed him some. I made some chicken and rice. He seemed to have an upset stomach. And all of a sudden, it's like he's a new dog.
Good, good.
And there has not been any of the collapsing. He hasn't had any of the problems. He's thrilled to have the chicken and rice. So I guess my question is, first of all, twofold, should we be moving further with this insulinoma thing since he's almost 12?
Yeah, yeah.
And secondly, what on earth is with the miracle food, chicken and rice?
Well, I don't think it's probably a miracle. I think it's tasty. He's eating it, and that's helping to keep his blood sugar from being in that critical low range. Insulinomas or an insulin secreting tumor in the pancreas. I'm glad that an ultrasound was done. The pancreas isn't the easiest organ since it's like way up in the cranial abdomen to be able to see the whole thing. And these tumors can be quite small and may be difficult to detect. So, if you were thinking you want to do something, you could do an exploratory to see if it's just a single nodule that can be surgically removed. But you may want to just consider managing it medically. There is a drug, I believe it's called diazoxide. I think that's what it's called. Sorry, I haven't treated one of these in a long time because we don't see them that often. But it is quite expensive, but it's kind of an anti-insulin drug. So it's not getting rid of the tumor, but it's helping your dog maintain normal blood sugar. But frequent meals throughout the day, so you're not getting big, swings and so on. Lots of little meals may help keep your dog, just on an even keel as well. And, your question is, a 12-year-old dog, boy, age isn't a disease, and your pet could, potentially some. I mean, we see dogs living well into their teens in many cases, and it's up to you as an owner to be able to look at the whole package. Does your dog have arthritis? Does he have other things going on that may be making his quality of life not that great? And then you throw this tumor on top of it, and that may be the thing that tells you how far you want to go with the workup. But it sounds like your vet is right on top of everything.
Thanks for that call, Karen. We're talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in today for Larry Mueller, and you can join in by calling 1-800-642-1234. You can also post on our Facebook page. That's The Larry Mueller Show. And Beth actually did post on the Facebook page. She says, our 95-pound lab mix injured his front paw or leg chasing a Frisbee. His paw is now droopy and he limps badly. Our vet prescribed Rimadryl and rest, but no improvement at all. Thoughts or suggestions? The poor guy, he's not having any fun this summer.
Oh, and we have to tell people if they've had a joint injury with one of their pets that they have to be rested. It can be a problem. I had a couple in, or an owner in yesterday who had his older lab had to have some surgery done and so is on forced bed rest for a little bit. And they have a new puppy who is now going crazy because that doesn't have the older dog to play with and they have to keep them separated. And so they're like, what do we do? And so this is the same kind of thing. You have to come up with ways of keeping your dog, mentally stimulated without, using a lot of food and having them gain a lot of weight because they can't be exercising. What I'm worried about is the fact that what you described as droopy is, did your dog actually, was it an orthopedic problem or is it a neurologic problem? Do we have some nerve damage or something that is affecting the dog's ability to be able to use its leg? Rimadyl is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory that helps with taking down inflammation and controlling pain. It's probably not going to do anything for nerve damage. And so, you know, I would be, you know, maybe either calling your veterinarian again or getting a second opinion if your vet can't figure it out and say, hey, is there some nerve damage here? And, you know, what do we have to be watching for? What can we do? Sometimes physical therapy during these forced rest periods are helpful as well. It helps maintain the muscle structure and you know, gives the dog, you know, some form of exercise, but again, very controlled exercise. So that would be another thing to look into.
Great. Let's go back to the phones and Rhonda in Dane. Hi, Rhonda.
Hi.
What's your question?
I have a 3-year-old black lab that is urinating a lot to where his urine is clear and drinks a lot. And I had a cat that was diabetic that had the same type of loss of weight also that had the same type of symptoms. And he ended up being diabetic, and I gave him 2 shots a day for 9 years, and he lived a great life. And I just lost him. So I'm very concerned about it. I went to the vet. They did the blood work. They ruled out liver, kidney, diabetes, which was good. They were looking at Addison's and Cushing's and ran a cortisol level, and it was normal. So we're kind of, and he was losing weight. So we're kind of just watching him right now. But I'm just really concerned. I don't want to wait in case there's something that I should be trying.
Wow, it sounds like your veterinarian is just doing. When you started talking, I was writing down my list of things: get lab work done, rule out this, rule out that. And your veterinarian has done everything I would be doing. And you know what I would be doing in a case like this where I can't figure it out and I've got all these normal lab tests is I would be walking down the hall to one of our internal medicine specialists and say, help, I need to have you go over this case with me because I am stumped. I can't figure out what's going on. That would be my best advice for you is gather up all those lab tests, talk to your veterinarian and say, can I get someone else to look at this? And there are, you know, several internists around the state that you can go to. We have a whole slew of them at the School of Veterinary Medicine, but there might be somebody closer that your veterinarian likes to work with to where you live. That's what I'd be recommending, because a 3-year-old dog that is producing dilute urine, you may be looking at some other kind of more oddball things. There's something called diabetes insipidus, which is not involving sugar, but more the pituitary, and it's a more of a brain disorder. And there's some other testing that can be done, like water deprivation tests and so on. But usually you'd want to probably be, you know, having that done by somebody that can really be carefully watching them. And maybe your veterinarian would be comfortable doing that, but maybe not. So I think another opinion would be next on my list.
Good luck with that, Rhonda. Let's go next to David in Madison. Hi, David.
Yeah, I know we're short on time, so I'll make it quick.
Oh, no, we're fine.
Oh, okay. Well, no, I got a dog from a shelter, and my wife got insurance, and the problems happened, and they didn't want to pay the bill. So, but they finally paid after 6-7 months of fighting. I was wondering, your vet expert, can you give me some names? And I canceled. But can you give me names of some quality pet insurance companies, number one? And what would be the average price for dogs and cats and pet insurance? And I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. There is a wonderful website to go to that's actually written by a veterinarian that, just like me, is like so confused about all the different insurance companies that are out there. And it's called petinsuranceuniversity.com. And I would strongly recommend that you go there. They compare all of the pet insurance companies that are available in the United States. You have to make sure that it is a company that is licensed in our state as well. But I just went through this with my own dog. And I have had, you're wondering, why does a veterinarian have pet insurance? I don't do surgery. That is one of the things. I stay away from sharp instruments. I prefer to just handle the medicine end of things. And so I carry insurance because I have bulldogs and you never know. And my dog had an oral mass and had to go in and have some surgery done. And it took me fighting with the insurance company to be able to get my payment. And it was because when I got him insured, he had some mild gingivitis, and that was just an inflamed gums. back when he was 3 years of age. He's now 10, and guess what? They were saying no, because he had this gingivitis, we're not going to cover anything in the oral cavity. And it was absolutely ridiculous. I mean, and so it took me threatening to go on the air and reveal what the company, who the company was. And finally, I did get reimbursed for a lot of the expenses. I got about $1,100 on a $1,500 bill back. So, but it took me fighting. And I've had to fight for many of my clients with pet insurance companies as well. It's very different than human health insurance. And so you have to do your homework. There are some that have breed, restrictions with certain breeds. They don't cover certain things. Obviously, pre-existing conditions are an issue. Cost can vary according to the age of the animal and sometimes even the breed of the animal. To give you an idea of what it costs, I'm paying $400 a year for both, each of my dogs. So it's costing me $800 a year for the pet insurance. And on both of them, I get my money's worth every year. But it does take a lot of work.
So that website is petinsuranceuniversity.com. We'll put that up on the Facebook page.
Perfect.
So people can link to that. I think that's a question a lot of us have.
And it's, I'm not going to recommend one company because there's issues with all of them, but there are some that are better than others. And the one that I have for my pets, I never recommend anymore, but I can't really say it on the air. Sorry.
That's fine. Yep. But petinsuranceuniversity.com is a good place to compare.
Right.
Great. And it sounds like it really depends on your animal and the breed, which is the best for you.
Right.
Anyway.
Right.
We're talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. And we are talking about how to keep our pets happy and healthy. There's a lot more to talk with her about. And we'd enjoy having you join in as well. You can call 1-800-642-1234. What's going on with your dog's or cat's health? And has your dog ever gotten sick from blue-green algae or other summer issues? We'd like to hear about that. And we're also going to be talking about at-home diagnostic kits coming up. If you've used one of those, we would love to hear about your experiences. Stay tuned. We'll be back in just a moment. We are talking with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine today, talking about your pet's health. And Sandy, let's go back to the phones and Dennis in Toma. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning, ladies. I have two questions, one question for each a different dog. The first dog is a Shih Tzu Poo male, neutered, and 11 years old. He's been diagnosed with Lyme's disease. He's had it for several years now, and we brought him back in, and he has another reoccurrence. The vet put him on doxycycline, and the pill is so huge that it's hard for, for me to give to the dog. And when I do give it to the dog, his reaction afterwards is he just like stands, like he's spaced out.
Huh.
In talking with the vet again, I elected to stop the doxycycline because of the pill being so big.
Mm-hmm.
And my question in this case is, if I discontinue giving him the doxycycline, how will that affect his Lyme's disease in the future?
Well, it's interesting. When we start looking at blood samples that we run on dogs, a very large percentage of dogs are positive, test positive for being exposed to the Lyme disease organism. Does that mean that they actually have clinical disease? No. The majority of dogs never develop any clinical signs. And so I like to tell people that I treat patients, I don't treat lab tests. And so if you get a positive back, and your dog is not showing any signs of fever, lameness, the common kidney disease and so on, the common things that we see with Lyme disease, then we don't treat. We just monitor and hike up our tick control to make sure that that they're not getting re-exposed. Because even if they had gone through it, they can get re-exposed again. It doesn't provide, past exposure doesn't provide future protection. I'd be making sure that your dog is vaccinated for Lyme disease and is on, a good flea and tick control product as well that your veterinarian recommends. The issue with just treating dogs has become a huge one lately, because doxycycline around the country, not only for pets, but humans as well, is an extreme short supply. And a prescription that would normally cost $5 or $6 is now $300 or $400. And so it's still available, but it's so cost prohibitive. And so just saying, well, the medication won't hurt, so let's put the dog on it, is not a reason for using it anymore. We really need to be cautious with just throwing antibiotics at something. If your dog really truly has clinical Lyme disease, you can use other antibiotics. We know that amoxicillin, which is an inexpensive antibiotic, can have some benefit as well. And so maybe consider, if your dog is clinical, going ahead and putting your dog on some amoxicillin rather than the doxycycline. That's available in a liquid form, and it may be easier for your dog to be able to take.
And Dennis, you had a question about another dog also.
Yes, it's a cockapoo, female, spayed, about 5 years old. And ever since we got the dog is extremely skittish. And in fact, as long as we've had the dog, it one day it'll come by me, and the other day it'll come near me, and then with this look on her face that she's somewhat hesitant to come any further.
Yeah, you know, when we see pets that are shy like this, we know that it kind of comes from a couple of different places. One, we know it's highly genetic. And so that's why I always tell people, if they're going to be getting a puppy, make sure that you look at mom and dad, because the extremes of behavior, that overly shyness or extremely aggressive dog, can, you know, those tend to be highly heritable. We also know that there's that critical socialization period in a dog's life as well, where they need to be exposed to a whole bunch of things very early in life, so that they're then comfortable later in life with anything that life throws at them. And so depending on where this dog came from, how it was raised, if it was, you know, spent the first few, you know, weeks or years of its life or months of its life in a kennel, or, you know, in a very restricted environment, that dog may never come around. I have a bulldog right now. Her name's Vanna, and she's a wonderful, wonderful family dog. But very, I mean, I've had her now for 7 years, and she still, it takes her a long time to warm up to anybody new. She's very, as long as she can hide under a table, an hour or two later, she'll come out. And I know that, you know, she was well-loved before we got her. And, you know, that's just kind of her nature. And sometimes it's just a matter of accepting them the way they are. And if, you know, when she is being brave, that would be the time to encourage her with food treats and things to be able to come over to you and make her realize that, hey, you know, being a little more outgoing is worthwhile for me. So, but you may just have to accept her the way she is.
Thanks for that call, Dennis. And Dennis asked about his Shih Tzu poo and his Cockapoo. And now we have a question on the Facebook page from Tracy about her Yorkie poo.
Oh.
And she wonders if you have any suggestions. They're going on a trip for over a week, and they don't want their 2-year-old Yorkie poo to get too upset and homesick while staying with the grandparents.
Most dogs adjust pretty well to when you leave. And I think it's harder for us than it is for the pets. I just went on vacation for a week and was in email because I was out of the country with the pet sitters. And boy, you know, the dogs were fine. They had the dogs and cats. They had no problem at all. In fact, they loved having the new company and, you know, somebody else to play with them. And by the look of the treat container, lots and lots of treats were given out too. It was harder on me to know that I was leaving them. And so, you know, maybe what you need to do is just, you know, be on the phone, find out, you know, if everything's going okay, take the same food, bring the, you know, the dog bed, the same toys and so on. And your dog should do just fine. So, you know, don't worry. Enjoy your vacation. And I did, but it took me having to have, you know, contact with people to be able to enjoy my vacation.
Carolyn in Chippewa Falls is next. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a Westie female. She's almost 7 years old. We adopted her when she was 4. She came into rescue because of severe allergies. And when she first came into rescue, she had both skin infection that was both bacterial and fungal. So that was treated. They put her on a special diet because they were knew that she had issues with allergies. And we've continued a special diet for her. We have a lot of issues with skin outbreaks. She'll get like a couple of patches of skin where the skin is open and kind of scaly, and we've had to resort to antibiotic treatment. We did have her on Atopica.
Okay.
And she has a very t- touchy stomach, and we got to the point where every time we gave her the Atopica, she was just vomiting it back. So we stopped the Atopica. We've been using Benadryl three times a day. That helped some, but already this summer she's had two skin outbreaks, and we've had to put her on Simplicef.
Okay, an antibiotic, yeah.
When we do put her on antibiotics, we do put her on Prostora as well because she has a very, very touchy...
And what Prostora is a probiotic that helps maintain the active bacteria in the gut. So, yeah, you're doing everything. And this is, you know, unfortunately, when you start looking at how do you work on allergies, number one, selective breeding. You got your dog as an adult, as a rescue. Westies are like one of the poster child for allergies, very common in the breed. And unfortunately, that's something you can't change. Things that I would be recommending, make sure that you're bathing your dog on a regular basis, one or two times a week with a antifungal, antibacterial shampoo, regardless of how dirty or clean your dog is. Wash the dog's bedding on a weekly basis. If you've got an old dog bed that's older than a year, throw it out, because we know that things like house dust mites and so on, which are everywhere in bedding and things, can be one of the leading causes of allergies as well. The diets may help if they have, especially if you're using a hypoallergenic diet that's a limited antigen diet, meaning single proteins and so on, may help if they have food allergies. The other thing is some of these diets have extra fatty acids in them, and if your dog isn't on a fatty acid supplement, that may be helpful as well. I'd be seriously looking into having your dog allergy tested and consider going through allergy treatment. Testing is done either through a blood test or skin testing, and this is something that many veterinarians do in their practice. The nice thing now is that people were hesitant to do this because they would have to give their dog allergy shots, and they were afraid of needles, and they didn't want to go through that. There is now a treatment that is sublingual treatment, which is just given orally on a daily basis. Dogs tolerate it well, and that seems to really help them, too. The cyclosporine that you, the Atopica, the recommended dose, sometimes we have to go way back on it and gradually, get the dog's tummy used to it. So maybe consider not, throwing that out and saying we're not using it at all, but start at a lower dose and gradually get up to a more therapeutic dose. That may be helpful. But you're doing everything. Controlling those secondary infections is probably the big thing. And consider maybe a topical steroid spray or eardrops if those are a problem as well, and kind of getting rid of the itch locally. There is going to be a new, brand new drug coming out that I believe the Bayer company is making it, and it's going to be working actually on the itch scratch cycle on the nerve endings and working on that. And it's a very unique drug, and I'm thinking that once that hits the market, we're going to be able to help a lot of these dogs with allergies. But unfortunately, it's not available yet. But keep tuned to your veterinarian. In the next year or so, that should be available.
Thanks for that call, Carolyn. Let's go next to Kevin in Lake Nebagamon. Did I completely massacre that, Kevin?
It's Lake Nebagamon.
Nebagamon, sorry about that. Well,
Nebagamon, yeah, no problem.
What is your question? Sure.
Well, I have this big cat, and we moved out to a farm out there in Lake Nebagamon, and we've been letting him outside and everything, and he has been hunting mice like crazy. And he will sometimes get, up to 10, 11, 12 mice a day, and, he'll eat them. And I'm just wondering how healthy that is for him to be.
Well, that's something that veterinary nutritionists often joke about. The average mouse has about 30 calories, and your average cat can catch about 10 mice a day. And when they're an outdoor working cat, 300 calories a day is a pretty good calorie intake for them. So some people consider it the perfect diet for cats. We're not going to be finding mice in a can anytime soon on our grocery shelves. But what I would be worried about is if your cat is actually consuming these mice of parasitic diseases, So make sure your cat's on like a monthly hookworm, roundworm treatment, as well as maybe a tapeworm treatment as well. Toxoplasmosis would be another thing. So making sure that you keep that litter box clean on a daily basis to prevent some human contamination. But yeah, it sounds like your cat's pretty avid hunter, and hopefully that you're cutting back a little bit on the food inside so that those extra calories aren't going to his waistline.
It sounds like he's enjoying living in the country, though, Kevin.
Yes, he is. Thank you.
Sure.
You're welcome.
And so going into that just a little more, Sandy, if someone has a cat that's going out and hunting, whether it's mice or voles or birds, what are the signs that there might be parasitic
problems? Well, tapeworms look like little rice grain segments that will be coming either around the rectum or in the cat or dog's bedding as well. Thanks for bringing this up, though. There's actually a study that's going on right now for indoor-outdoor cats, and because bird predation obviously is a huge problem, and there's something called the Birds Be Safe Cat Collars. And then there's another thing that's a bib that the cat, it's called a cat bib that they wear, and it prevents them from being able to get, you know, flying, you know, birds and so on. And I don't know how well they work. There's actually a study going on out on the East Coast that's looking into, they're looking for volunteers in that location. But they're available online, and it might be something to put on your cat if they're going outside.
Well, and it's also something you can threaten your cat with, because there's somewhat embarrassing.
Yes, I know. They look like a big ruffle around their neck. Yeah.
It's another variation on the cone of shame.
Right, right.
But we have talked at length on the show on our environmental topics and other programs that billions of songbirds a year
definitely
are killed by cats.
Definitely. And then, you know, we've got the issue with the fecal material being deposited and all that stuff. You know, it's a huge environmental hazard. Cats are not a native species here.
Well, we have a lot more to talk about with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine right after this look at the news from NPR. Stay tuned. Just like with human health concerns, it can be stressful when a pet is ill. And with so much information out there, sometimes one item contradicting another, it can be hard to know where to turn. Hi, I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. So glad you could join us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Well, once a month, we have the chance to turn to Dr. Sandy Sawchuk of the UW School of Veterinary Medicine for useful advice. Dr. Sandy, always great to have you spend time with us.
I love doing this show. I've been doing it for years, and I still get questions that are like, huh, that's really, you know, well, there's always people out there that can stump me.
Well, good.
Yeah.
We hope you keep doing it for many more years. Well, Nancy in West Bend has been waiting a bit, and it's a topic that certainly affects a lot of us as pet owners. So let's go there next. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. And I'll try not to cry.
That's okay.
But my cat turned 21 in June.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. And she had been very, very healthy for most of that time, but in the last few months, she has developed some issues with eating and I think arthritis, because she can't really, like, hitch herself with her back legs.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been to the vet a few months ago, and I'd asked them if I could, you know, when it was time, if I could euthanize her at home.
Mm-hmm.
And my reason for doing it at home with just me is that I know that's how she's most comfortable.
Yeah. You know, this is something that is becoming, because pets have gone from the barnyard to the bedroom. I mean, there are extended family, and, you know, it's become so much a part of our life. And taking them for their last ride into an environment that has been associated with, you know, blood draws and physical exams and so on is just not how we want to see our pets' last moments to be. And because of that, there's a number of veterinarians that do home euthanasias, and in fact, it spawned an entire business of veterinarians that's pretty much all they do is going to people's homes. As a veterinarian at the vet school, that is something that I do offer my own clientele. Obviously, I'm not available 24 hours a day, and sometimes these decisions have to be made on off hours and so on. And so when we're getting to that point, where it need, where, you know, considering it needs to be done, I provide them with information from, for some of our local, you know, people that will do this. And that would be something hopefully your veterinarian has information on as well. There is, a kind of a website, and I don't know the exact name of it, but I'm sure if you just Googled at-home pet euthanasia, you'll get the this kind of clearinghouse. You put your state in, and then it lists veterinarians that do provide this service. And, you know, the people that are specializing in doing this really make it they really go the extra length to make sure that the pet is comfortable. They usually provide some pre-sedation, and then, you know, do the actual euthanasia so that, you know, there's no pain, there's no suffering. And, you know, I don't think I personally as a veterinarian could do this day in and day out. It's such an emotionally wrenching thing to be doing. But, you know, these people that these veterinarians that do it, oh, you know, they just they need to be blessed with just, you know, being able to be stable emotionally to help people like you. And I can tell you, I cry right along with my clients, and it's one of the hardest things we do, but also the best gift we can give them. So getting it done at home, by all means, I think that's the best thing that you can do for your kitty.
And Nancy, I would just add that I've been able to do that for some of my cat companions mm-hmm. over the years, and it really does reduce mm-hmm. that stress and for both the person mm-hmm. and the pet. And right. and that way, too, if there are other family members mm-hmm. that want to be there, sometimes it's a little easier.
And
that
sometimes
way
even other pets right. That are it's for them. It's I've seen all kinds of weird reactions where they've just turned their back, or they've gone over and sniffed, or they've laid next to them. And it's, I think, I don't know whether it helps or not, but I really think it's something that, you know, just makes it easier for everybody to be able to have, be able to cry and not be in a social situation where you feel you have to inhibit your emotions.
Sure. And Nancy, did that answer your question?
Yes. I mean, I can try to find that website. When I have to say that, you know, I have Googled it, and then when you, most of the things you get online, it's like, oh, you know, how could you ask such a question? Why'd you get a cat if you, you know, just want to kill it?
Oh, my goodness. No, no, no. I mean, I think, that, you know, just like anything, there are good places and bad places, and no one would at all question a 21-year-old cat that's ill that you're making a bad decision at all. So I'll give you the name of somebody that is in our area that offers this. It's Carrie Donahue, who's actually a guest on the show once in a while. And she has her business is called Full Circle Holistic Veterinary Care, and she does home euthanasias as well. And
I bet that Carrie would know people
in
the
that
West
area.
Bend area. And really, Nancy, you're making a very responsible decision mm-hmm. for your pet. So anyone that doesn't treat you that way really doesn't yeah. have any business working with
right,
you.
Right. I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
But you're
but
doing
yeah,
the right thing.
Full Circle Holistic Veterinary Care is Dr. Carrie Donahue's service, and as we said, she is based here in Madison. She is a guest on the show several times a year, but she would certainly know, I think, people that are mm-hmm. in your own area, Nancy. So good luck with that. It's a very difficult situation that a lot of us can relate to. Let's go next to Monica in Milwaukee. Hi, Monica.
Hi.
What's your question?
My question is, I have an odd situation with a German short-haired pointer who is 13 and a half years old. She has always had a delicate stomach, but, you know, they say it's because it's an inverted or, you know, a high stomach. But she threw up maybe every 6 weeks, 8 weeks for her lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
She, at one point, when she was 2 years old, needed an endoscopy. She swallowed a decoration off a cupcake. But but my question now is, yeah, and we had to fish it out.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, we went through the x-rays and then a special diet all to come round to an endoscopy and get that taken out of her. Well, now, my question now is, we left for a vacation on Tuesday, July 30th. We came back on the Thursday, so about 3 days. And I found 3 spots of vomiting when I came home in our Wisconsin mm-hmm. room. And she has vomited every day since, except for 2. So it's about 2 weeks now.
Yeah.
And it's always between 4 and 6 o'clock. It is just bile.
Uh-huh.
And she's eating fine. Right after that, she gets hungry and she goes eat. She eats her normal amount.
Yeah, yeah.
She takes water as usual. She wakes up in the morning and drinks her water. Her whole schedule is normal.
Yeah.
She poops regularly. She takes my regular walk with her. She fetches once in a while because she's got some arthritis. But nothing else has changed other than this vomiting once a day between 4 and 6 o'clock.
And this is at in the afternoon, 4 or 6 o'clock in the afternoon. Okay.
Yeah. Well, and the question is, you know, she's 13 and a half. We just had a large expense at the ER room because she had that old dog ear vertigo.
The vestibular disease, yeah. Uh-huh.
Yes, yes. And, you know, then again, when she was two, I spent quite a bit on endoscopy. So at 13 and a half, my husband is a little reluctant.
Yeah. Well, I think I've got a couple of suggestions for you. When we see dogs that they're getting to that point where their stomach is empty, a very common occurrence, and for most dogs, that's why I asked when it is occurring, whether it's morning or evening. For most dogs, it's usually in the morning. They've been laying in a certain position, they haven't had anything in their stomach, and they get a little bile refluxing up into their stomach. It's almost like us getting like acid reflux, but this is bile reflux, and that bile is irritating to the stomach. They vomit it up, and then once it's out of there, they feel good. They go back to eating again, and they're not having any trouble. So a couple of things that you might want to try at home, if, you know, going in, and obviously a workup would be recommended, going in and having her, you know, physical exam and maybe an x-ray or whatever done just to make sure everything's normal. But if that's not in the cards, things that you can try at home. One would be, you know, making sure she has food in the afternoon before this episode. So getting something into her tummy 2 or 3 o'clock in the afternoon. So, and so for dogs that are doing this in the early in the morning, we just say feed them before bed. Give them a nice snack before they go to sleep at night. And that helps just to have something in the stomach for them to be working on. The other thing that you may want to consider, and this would be something your veterinarian could give you a dose of, is getting them going on some like Pepcid AC, which is available over the counter. Famotidine is the brand name. And that helps some of these dogs as well with making sure that, you know, it just helps control the stomach upset. And some dogs do well with just doing that, extra food and, you know, getting them on some famotidine, and you never have any troubles again. But if that doesn't work, then I think you're kind of, you know, at that point where, you know, you may want to consider having some things looked into.
All right. Thanks for that call, Monica. And we had a Facebook question from Brent going back to that issue with the blue-green algae. He says, we have a one-year-old Great Dane who loves wading in the Wisconsin River at our local park. There's algae downstream from the park where the flow of the river slows to form Lake Wausau, but not at the park where he swims and drinks. Would Dr. Sandy suggest revoking river privileges?
Probably not. When you put the water flowing like that, it's very unlikely that you're going to be having any issues. I mean, you could still have issues with leptospirosis and giardia and so on. But I think if, you know, the water is visibly looking clean, I go ahead and enjoy that. It's just kind of the standing water that looks yucky. That's the areas you really want to avoid.
Let's go back to the phones and Farah in Benton. Hi, Farah.
Hi. I had a question. We've got a 5-year-old cat that I found when she was a kitten, and she's indoor, outdoor, and she gets tapeworms.
Mm-hmm.
And the vet said that they get them from eating mice.
Mm-hmm.
So should we be worming her like every 4 to 6 weeks all year long?
That's a good question. Right now, the Center for Disease Control recommends that minimum of quarterly deworming for cats that are hunters or dogs that are hunters as well. So that would be every 3 months. But the issue is, you know, she's between those 3 months, is she going to be running into troubles again? And there are very safe medications that you can use. You can get the drug that we typically use is called Praziquantel, and you can buy it over the counter. I've seen it at our local farm store. You can get it, you know, without a prescription online. But it tastes horrible when you use it in that form. It's a tableted form of medication that is just horrible, horrible, horrible to try to get down a cat. There's a spot-on formula called Profender that is, it comes in a little tube that's well-tolerated by cats. It gets roundworms, hookworms, and tapeworms. And so that might be something that you would want to talk to your veterinarian about. And using that maybe, you know, again, on a monthly basis would be probably the best medicine if your cat's out hunting like that. But at minimum would be quarterly is what's recommended.
Okay. And I don't know, I kind of tuned in late if you talked about like flea and tick control, if that would help too.
Well, fleas can carry another type of tapeworm. And so if the cat eats a flea, grooms a flea off, there's another tapeworm called Diplodium that they can get. And so we see two different types of tapeworms in this area. And so any cat that's an indoor-outdoor cat should be on heartworm medication, flea and tick control. And most of those products are also going to be covering the common intestinal parasites like roundworms and hookworms. It gets into a little tricky when you're trying to get rid of tapeworms because you have to use a separate product for that. So, yes, your pet should be on something on a monthly basis. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of different combinations of things that you can use. Unfortunately, there isn't one product that's going to do everything. So you're probably looking at using a flea and tick product and a dewormer or, you know, heartworm control and a dewormer. You know, so lots of different combinations of things, and that would be something to work out with your veterinarian.
Thanks for that call, Farah. We had a Facebook question from Joy. She says, our 14-year-old German Shorthair has developed an obsession with licking any wound. He had surgery to remove a mass from the inside upper part of his hind leg this winter and has been in an e-collar almost ever since. After the original surgical wound healed, that area seems fragile and is easily scraped. He seems to like bitter apple, which is supposed to be a deterrent. Mm-hmm. And she says, we can't find any bandages or covers that will stay on that area. Any suggestions that would allow us to take off the obnoxious e-collar?
Well, there are e-collars. There's a couple of other things that are out there. Most people look at e-collars as those big plastic lampshade type things. There's some softer e-collars that are made out of fabric that work for some dogs. There's even something that looks like an inner tube that can go around their neck. And most dogs find that quite comfortable, yet it prohibits them from being able to get back and work at a wound. Why some dogs start picking at an area, whether there's some nerve pain there that's causing some trouble, whether it has just become a compulsive disorder for the dog. And, you know, we know that dogs do develop OCDs just like people do. And so it's kind of like a person biting their fingernails to the quick or twizzling their hair, doing something repetitively like that. They kind of get into the licker's high. And obviously that can be a problem because they're going to start damaging the skin. So making sure that there isn't any secondary infections there that can be adding to the itch, keeping the e-collar on until that place is totally healed up. Consider using another chew deterrent. There is something that I like that's called Yuck. It's a gel form. It's absolutely vile tasting because I've got it on my fingers and accidentally got it in my mouth. And oh my God. Yeah. It's like, it definitely Yuck is the best name for it. So you may want to consider trying something like that as well. But these can be really tough cases. And in some cases, we've even had to resort to psychoactive drugs to help break that compulsive disorder, things like fluoxetine, Prozac, which is now labeled for dog use.
Thanks for that call. And Sandy, you had mentioned to me that there are a lot of at-home diagnostic kits being marketed now for our pets. And I know you wanted to talk about that. What kinds of tests are being sold for home use?
Oh, my goodness. Well, this started by my dermatologist bringing up a test called the Immune IQ. And this isn't even a run by a veterinarian. And when you start looking at their website and there are so many spelling errors, you start questioning the validity of the test. But this is supposedly a test that rules out allergies, toxins, and so on that causes your pets to itch and chew and cause ear infections and watery eyes and more. Then you send in saliva and hair. And, you know, things that really set off some alarms with this are, you know, the fact that they say it costs $2,000 to $3,000 to get your dog allergy tested. I don't know what veterinarian is charging that much, but there's no way that's not that expensive to have your dog allergy tested.
They're saying that don't go to your test because otherwise you're going to.
Yeah. And they also start talking about things like, you can look for bacteria and viruses that can be causing skin issues. to my knowledge, there are no viruses that can cause skin infections. So that's bizarre. Molds and funguses instead of fungi, funguses. Okay. So obviously they need a little bit of work. So, you know, $87, save your money, go to your veterinarian and actually have the testing done right. The best one, though, is an at-home heartworm test kit. And this is, heartworm testing is actually a pretty easy thing to do. It does require a blood sample, though. And that's the only way to test for heartworm. And this is a test kit that you can buy. And it says, you know, accurate results saves you $50 to $100 a dog. I mean, we do at our vet clinic a test called the 40X test, which looks for heartworm, Lyme, Ehrlichia, Anaplasma, the tick-borne diseases as well. And I think it's about $45, $47 for the test. So it's you know, relatively inexpensive. And they're saying here, you know, oh, over $100. But this is the kicker. They say you have to collect your own blood sample. And what they say is you have to cut a nail too short and have bleed into a tube. And they said, well, you know, no pain, no gain is on their video. And I just can't believe that they would say that. And they said, well, maybe you know somebody. They also say, you know, take it. Maybe you know a vet tech or somebody that can do an IV, you know, blood draw for you, too. You know, again, get this done right so that your dog is not going to be shy of having its feet handled. Yes, nails periodically do get cut too short, but that's not a way to collect a blood sample for that.
And there's a risk of infection.
Oh, everything. Okay. And then, you know, other things, there's an at-home diabetes test kit that you can get on Amazon. And all it is a dipstick that checks for urine or sugar in the urine. And they're marketing this for managing diabetes. You cannot manage diabetes with just checking urine. It's blood tests. That's why people have to, you know, prick right. themselves and do it. We do the same thing. And we do have at-home blood testing kits that owners can use where it just takes a drop of blood. And we teach owners how to use either an ear vein or whatever in their cat. And it's very painless and easy to use. But here it's $12.95 for a single urine test. And yet this is, you know, the way it's being marketed is that, you know, we can manage your own dog's and cat's diabetes by using our little test kit. So lots and lots of stuff out there. Again, your veterinarian is the best place to go for testing and information, and don't buy the kits online.
Well, and a false positive or a false negative could cause problems
way. You know, and as a veterinarian, if someone came in and said, hey, I did this test and I bought it and these are the results, I would probably say, I want to do it again anyways. I'm not going to trust somebody that is a, you know, fly-by-night. You know, charlatan that's trying to take your money. So
good information. Yeah. Let's take a quick call from Nancy in Grafton. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. My granddaughter is 10 and she wants a dog. She has some allergies. What would be a good breed?
Well, any of the dogs that don't shed. So poodles, schnauzers, and so on. There is no hypoallergenic dog or non-allergenic dog. But the dogs that don't shed tend to be tolerated a little bit better. Always try on an adult dog first as a breed. A lot of times puppies, you tolerate them, and then as they mature and their skin chemistry and oil levels and so on change, then you become allergic. So try on an adult dog first to see how your granddaughter tolerates them. And you may find that just doing simple things like damp mopping your dog, you know, bathing it on a weekly basis to get rid of, you know, some of the allergens on their hair coat may be helpful as well. But I'd go with one of the non-shedding breeds.
Thanks for that call, Nancy. And Sandy, here we are.
I know. Another
it's
hour
amazing
and a half
how
goes
quickly
by.
Things go. So just to recap a couple of things, careful of the algae.
Yep.
Drinking or skin contact mm-hmm. can be an issue. And the pet insurance site that you mentioned is up on Facebook, petinsuranceuniversity.com, to compare different
right.
pet insurance
Less
policies.
Less than 2% of people have pet insurance. And I really think it's something that the people that do have it and are working with a company that is reliable, the care that they're able to provide for their pet is often great.
Great. Thanks for that and all the great advice you shared today, Sandy.
You're welcome.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. She's on the second Tuesday of the month, so her next appearance will be Tuesday, September 10th. That's fall. Maybe we won't have to worry about some of those things. Coming up tomorrow, we have a couple environmental topics. We'll talk with the editor of Our Wisconsin magazine, and we'll talk about aquatic invasive plants. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks for listening.